impulses are being redirected. We are living in an artificially induced state of consciousness that resembles sleep.
Dissonance.
The fans of the angelic force.
Hello, hello, everybody.
Greetings. Welcome once again this last day of July. To another installment of Precognitive Dissonance. I'm Craig York.
And I'm Smiles Lewis, and hopefully the volume and everything is coming across all right out there.
I'm at a remote, undisclosed location, and Miles is at Precognitive Headquarters, where he's experiencing some kind of computer weirdness, which is sort of, you know, it's as it should be. our show should be as anomalous as the anomalies we report.
And I am experiencing anomalies just out of the blue, with sound problems, and everything appears to be functioning, and the voices in our heads coming out of our mouths seem to be going out over the airwaves.
But if you try and call in during the program and weird things happen, don't say we didn't warn you.
Yeah, and if you'd like to call in, please do. We'd love to hear from you at 1-800-something-something-something-something-something. Or 512-646-4404. Oh, yeah, the 1-800 number is, in fact, 513-0105. Toll-free 800-513-0105. So, as always, lots of news to cover, and ranging from cryptozoological to ufological.
And biological.
Oh, yes.
But, as always, psychological. Well, maybe I'm exaggerating. But, anyway, I'll apologize for any delays on my end. My computer is not the fastest in the world. Right now I'm looking at one of our cryptozoological stories, a story that's broken in a couple of places, but first showed up in Montauk.
Ah, yes.
Which is
New York, no stranger to strangeness. Montauk gets mentioned actually in the really awesome, fairly modern film with Jim Carrey, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Ah, yes.
And
oh, was that set in Montauk?
I think there's a line, something to the effect of, meet me in Montauk, and that's so at least part of it takes place there. Montauk's most known for its alleged connections to the Philadelphia experiments, or rather the aftermath of the alleged Philadelphia experiment, and involves various psychotronic technologies and time travel and remote viewing type of technologies, and the unleashing of some sort of id creature that supposedly wrecked one of the military bases there, or something like that.
That's further into Philadelphia than I've ever gone. I knew about the weirdness associated with the ship itself, but holy mackerel, an id monster, Miles?
That's, like I said, that's not actually directly related to the Philadelphia experiment, but the cottage industry of books that followed in the wake of all channeled through Montauk, it seems like. But I haven't really read most of those works. Just didn't think there was much worth... Not much to learn there, I didn't think, but there I go, being overly skeptical.
Well, yeah, and you certainly do to an extent. Yeah, I mean, it's not even a matter of skepticism, Miles. It's a matter of world enough and time. You know,
yeah, where you want to spend your energy, and hopefully,
even in a niche like the paranormal, you know, there is such an incredible volume of material that you wind up having to specialize to an extent. You know, if you're going to pursue anything in any depth. But anyway, great sidebar.
The Montauk Monster started showing up in news reports around Montauk, apparently, and on the blogosphere, including Crypto Mundo, which is where I first heard about it. Or wait, no. Oh, I forget now. But
I'm
following it there.
I think The Anomalist. And The Anomalist started the ball rolling with a link to a blog called Gawker. I'm looking at the same image at Forget Amori. And Mori writes, someone sent the image above to Gawker warning that there is, quote, a government animal testing facility very close by in Long Island, end quote. But being a good blog, Gawker sure as hell knew that it probably wasn't what it looked like. The Talk Monster must have been yet another viral marketing ploy. Good suspect emerged. Cryptids are real, from Cartoon Network, which is, by the way, a very interesting site with good fictional depictions of unusual encounters with giant flying jellyfishes and the like. The Montauk Monster looks like a griffin with its puzzling beak, even though the wings and claws do not fit. I think there is a news story associated with it, or else there were more posts on Gawker. But the professional consensus seems to be that it's either a dead dog or a dead raccoon. Apparently there are also allegations of photoshoppery, which was honestly what I suspected at first. It's an interesting creature. It appears to be skinless, or not skinless, but hairless, although from certain angles it looks like there might be a residue of very fine fur on the animal. But its hindquarters look very leathery, as does the rest of its body. Its skin has a very mottled appearance, which actually resembles severe bruising in some respects. And its forepaws appear to be bound together. Its legs, you know, from what can be seen, do appear fairly dog-like. It's one of those. The image raises a couple of questions for me. One is the face. The whole business of an animal, you know, altering its form or coming to resemble something that it's really not. The classic example is the basking shark corpses. You remember that one very famous photograph, the Japanese fishing vessel.
Black and white photo, and it's all just a drooping mass on a hook or something.
It was on a boom. But it looked for all the world like the corpse of a plesiosaur. I mean, it was a sensation.
Yeah.
And, you know, come to find out that the basking shark, which is, you know, I think the second largest shark after the whale shark, which can reach fairly phenomenal lengths, something on the order of 25 or 30 feet, when one dies, the corpse will float, and one of the first things that will rot and fall away is the lower jaw and the gill structure. But anyway, so the neck and the rest of the head comes to resemble a long, thin neck attached to a very bulky body with a pair of flippers on it.
Looking like a plesiosaur.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My wife asserts that it's pig-like, and
that has also been suggested by some folks. There's a thread I was following over at Rigorous Intuition forums, and That's actually also where the blogger Jeff Wells informed me that, going back to this theme of viral marketing, that the computer company Alienware apparently has been marketing some of its latest laptops using carrot drone glyphs. And they're saying they're not claiming responsibility, but that they're appropriating it and incorporating it. And so far, I don't think anybody sued them. So either the person who created it doesn't mind and doesn't want to reveal themselves by making a stink. But then, lo and behold, you know, there's like you were saying, some of the early suspicions about this critter were that it was a hoax of some type of viral marketing. And you mentioned the Crypt is a Real Cartoon Network bit. And Lauren Coleman over at CryptoMundo.com reports that a Texas-based energy drink company is now taking up the giving out a bounty for...
Venom Energy Drink,
yeah.
I believe it is. Yep.
Venom Energy Drink offers bounty for the capture of a live Montauk monster. And apparently this is Plano, Texas, July 31st, 2008, or at least maybe that's the newspaper that was reporting it's from Plano. Dedicated to enabling the most thrill-seeking conquest known to man or beast, Venom Energy Drink. Energy Drink is offering a free product for life and a corporate monster hunting sponsorship to the first person brave enough to capture a live Montauk monster. Now, and they throw in what some people have suggested, that it's a de-shelled turtle. But it's the most sane collection of remarks I guess I've seen about this seems to be at Forget Omori, where he quotes the people who variously say it's a raccoon or those who say it's a dog, and they seem to be experts who give some, you know, decent explanation for some of the seemingly anomalous elements of this critter. But it's, and certainly it could be a matter of misperception, but the most anomalous thing I'd say about this picture is the appearance of a beak that I think is suggested in the Forget Omori article that he links to somebody saying that that's actually part of its upper jaw misaligned or something like that, or maybe that's what they're saying, the apparent bottom set of
beak. That's kind of the reason I brought up the bit about the basking shark photo, is that the thing... The only thing that bugs me about that explanation is that if it's the case that the snout was either chewed or rotted away, the rest of the body is, you know, remarkably intact. And it seems to me that if it were any kind of result of scavenging, if you study the photograph, the eyes appear to still be in their sockets. They're closed, the lids are closed, but, you know, they don't look sunken. It doesn't look like there's, you know, any kind of damage to them at all. Now, you know, it's...
There's also this, what appears to be hair or fur, almost, around the rim of its head, or something.
And there's something else I'm realizing as I'm looking at it a little closer. The explanation of a bulldog has been offered, and if you twist your head to the side a little bit, what it looks like, what appears to be a beak, is actually a rill of sand. Just below the animal's head, and just up from that appears to be a pug nose. You can, if you look closely, you can make out what appears to be a pair of nostrils right where the edge of the beak would be on the upper jaw. So I think it's a matter of the head is perhaps rotated a little bit more closely, or else, you know, there's more, you know, there's some kind of trauma on the far side of it. But
All in all, it's pretty grisly, I tell you.
Yeah. But I have to say, you know, like I say, now that I've looked at it more closely, and the thing that bothers me about the notion of being viral marketing is that, you know, the animal's forelegs
appear to be tied.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as one poster points out, I believe, in one of the CryptoLindo posts, the simplest way to dispose of an unwanted animal is by drowning.
Yeah.
Isn't all that often that we dispose of something that quickly?
Poor critter.
Oh, well.
If it's real, poor critter.
And yeah.
If it is viral marketing, it just makes me like it less and less, or at least the way it's being applied. But
it may not be.
It probably isn't. I would hope not.
Well, I find it hard to believe that a kid show would use something like this. From the shores of the sea to outer space, our regular listeners will recall that last week we talked a little bit about the recent radio interview with former astronaut Ed Mitchell. And now, some of the fallout, feedback, and flack surrounding that event, come to find out that, you know, this was not the first time Mitchell had gone on record with something like that. But just about the time that I'm about to go, well, you know, maybe I was a little bit more excited than I had reason to be, along comes a, not exactly colleague, but someone else with a long history with NASA, saying that, yes, what Mitchell is saying is correct, and he goes even further. This is a fellow who claims to have seen an 8 to 9 foot alien standing, conversing, or, you know, communicating somehow with two astronauts in the open cargo bay of the space shuttle while it was in orbit. I'm waiting for the link to
resolve. This is a NASA expert claims to have seen ET from UFO standing in shuttle payload bay during spaceflight. NASA veteran Clark C. McClelland, that's McClelland, confirms alien existence as outlined by astronaut Edgar Mitchell. Clark C. McClelland, former SCO, Space Shuttle Fleet, personally observed an 8 to 9 foot tall ET on his 27 inch. He changes tense there.
Yeah.
Perfect. Wonderful. Yeah. This guy's been getting traction on websites like Rents.com and Canada.com or that blog that seems to be like a completely exopolitical blog for Canada.
I know Canada Daily.
Canada, is that what it is?
I think so.
And I recall also that I think we talked about this guy about a year ago, or more recently. But the article that I found me of what we were talking about was, again, at Rents.com. This is from 777, July 7, 2007. Von Braun was at Roswell, world exclusive by Clark C. McClelland. He's the guy who claims that he met up at least once or twice with Von Braun, who made allusions to Roswell, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, and I'll be posting the link to that, of course, at precognitivedissonance.com when we post this episode for tonight. He said, then, during my long years of service in our national space program, I was very fortunate to come to know and exchange some very exciting data with former German scientists who had been brought to the USA under Operation Paperclip following World War II. These men were the elite of the German rocket programs controlled by Adolf Hitler. On many occasions, I had the distinct privilege of speaking with Dr. Werner von Braun, the leader of the elite group, and several other scientists who were assigned to the ABMA, Army Ballistics Missile Agency, launch crews at the Cape Canaveral launch sites. Let's see, what was the gist of that? Well, anyway, Von Braun explained how he and his unnamed, for now, associates had been taken to the crash site after most of the military were pulled back. They did a quick analysis of what they found. He told me the craft did not appear to be made of metal, as we know metal on Earth. He said it seemed to be created from something biological, like skin. I was lost as to what he indicated, other than thinking perhaps the craft was alive. The recovered bodies were temporarily being kept in a nearby medical tent. They were small, very frail, and had large heads. Their eyes were large, their skin was grayish and reptilian in texture. He said it looked similar to the skin texture of rattlesnakes he'd seen several times at White Sands. His inspection of the debris had even him puzzled. Very thin, aluminum-colored, like silvery chewing gum wrappers. Very light and extremely strong, the interior of the craft was nearly bare of equipment, as if the creatures in craft were part of a single unit. Did that other page, the more recent news, ever pull up for you?
Yeah. I went on ahead to the Anomalous, actually, and apparently the site we've got this from, Australia.to, has been running UFO stories of late. There's one from a couple of days ago that what UFOs are. This is the link at the Anomalous. Charles Upton, author of Cracks in the Great Wall, UFOs and Traditional Metaphysics, offers his interpretation of the iconic phenomenon, arguing that UFOs are real. Some groups with their own interests at stake are disseminating disinformation, and the entire exercise is aimed at softening up the world's populace for becoming one world government and one world religion. Is Upton suffering a bout of extreme paranoia, or are they out to get us? I remember what you're talking about now, and I remember being kind of... Of course, you know how my knee jerks up at any mention of Roswell. It's just one of those... the simplest explanation seems to me to be the best. But...
Well, I know Michael Mott of MottyMorphic.com had been speculating that perhaps this recent rash of Edgar Mitchell quoting in regards to imminent disclosure and claims of ET contact with the governments of the worlds was perhaps connected to his past association with the X-Files franchise, which of course the X-Files just came out recently, and of course, it's this particular movie, unlike the first and only other X-Files movie, has nothing to do with UFOs at all. So it seems kind of ill-timed if it is supposed to be that. But that made me recall that it was nearly 4 years ago that this same kind of hype was generated in the UFO community by. Claims that Edgar Mitchell was about to make some grand disclosure, and I had posted such announcement myself from the there was an announcement from the conference called The Field, which was a consciousness conference, I believe, that occurred over in England, and the news announcement then, this is from September of 2004, Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell to reveal new evidence of the existence of UFOs and extraterrestrial beings at the Living the Field Conference 2004. I particularly wanted you to hear this exciting news about our forthcoming Living the Field annual conference at the Logan Hall Institute of Education in London. This was to be in October 2004, which promises to be a truly historic occasion. This will be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to hear some of the greatest living scientists and psychics, people such as Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, whose vision of a connected universe and subsequent research into human consciousness have reshaped our understanding of how we can positively influence the world around us. Edgar Mitchell will disclose startling new evidence gathered from extremely reliable high-level military sources, from other astronauts, and even from the survivors of Roswell, New Mexico, where he grew up, that extraterrestrial life not only exists, but has also made contact with Earth. He will also be exposing the secret Men in Black-style agency, which has operated for decades to suppress this information.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. What's old is new. What's new is old.
And the short-term memory of humanity is getting shorter all the time. Well, anyway, it'll be interesting to see if, you know, this latest round of revelation actually produces anything. I'm kind of skeptical, as I think I put in my email to you. You'll note the very last thing the fellow says at the end of the article is, "I am willing to reveal all, for compensation." I confess, I'm kind of skeptical about the whole X-Files link. And,
yeah, but
know,
it deserved, mentioning. Again, that's viral marketing.
Well, yeah, that's, and it's a puzzling kind of, you know, everything can't be viral marketing.
Everything is a conspiracy.
Well, anyway.
I've got something towards that for the end of the show, but we'll get to that later.
Okay. Well, let's make it a jagged orbit and descend from, you know, the the deeps of space to fishing worms. This is something I ran across looking at The Economist the other day. And interestingly enough, it's filed under material science, an article called Rags to Riches from the July 24th, 2008 issue of The Economist. The jaws of ragworms may yield a valuable new material. When it comes to prospecting for advanced materials, the animal kingdom rarely comes to mind. Yet engineers sometimes find that the forge of evolution produces more impressive substances than those devised by the human brain. Spider silk, for example, is stronger than steel and is now finding its way into bulletproof jackets. And the ridges and furrows of a gecko's ceiling-grasping toes have inspired a glueless adhesive tape. The newest candidate for translation from the animal to the human world, though, looks even more unlikely. Chris Brummell and Herbert Waite of the University of California, Santa Barbara, have been studying the jaws of ragworms, which, as careless fishermen who have used them for bait can attest, can give a nasty nip. I'll leave it to you, Miles, to look up a picture of a ragworm and perhaps post it. But the article goes on to state that in studying these fairly mundane, presumably seashore creatures, they discovered that the jaws, at the front of their bulbous blue heads, they have curved fangs that act as jaws. They use these to capture and tear apart their crustacean prey. And apparently, they contain enormous amounts of zinc. This was apparently known for a while, but in the 1980s, ecologists looking for organisms that could be used as indicators of oceanic pollution took a keen interest in ragworms. These ecologists found that the worm's jaws contained a lot of zinc, a metal that is toxic in large doses. Their initial suggestion was that the worms were dumping excess zinc into their jaws, where it could do no harm, as a way of keeping their bodies free of poison. Measuring the zinc in ragworm jaws was thus thought of as a way of monitoring zinc pollution. That suggestion, however, fell apart when it became clear that the jaws of worms from clean water, too, were stuffed with zinc. The ecologists lost interest, but the engineers were intrigued. Eventually, Dr. Brummell and Dr. Waite decided to have a look at what was really going on. And in a nutshell, in the proteins that the worm secretes to create its jaws, the jaws themselves are made of a mixture of protein and zinc ions. The protein in question contains a lot of an amino acid called histidine. Indeed, it has 10 times more histidine than the average protein. Histidine likes to bind tightly to zinc ions. The consequence is a material composed of histidine-rich proteins, and zinc is extremely strong. But lacking the dense calcium salts of mineralized biological structures, it is also quite light. So, in a sense, it's a kind of organic metal. And as one of the commentators points out, the fact that all of this occurs as a simple biological process at more or less normal pressure and temperature is little short of miraculous. The material scientists are looking at whether or not these amino acids can be synthesized, and if so, you're looking at something that might have the strength of, say, aluminum with a quarter the weight. And, it's one of those, it might offer, in some forms of construction, an alternative to things like graphite composites or fiberglass for aircraft boat construction. I'm just kind of intrigued that the biological aspect of it. As it says, large quantities of, zinc are toxic, and that's one of the more common forms of long-term poisoning is, heavy metal poisoning. Zinc, mercury, lead, of course. But the notion of there being an effective biological process to remove those toxins from the body, that seems to me to be worth studying all by itself.
Well, you're listening to Precognitive Dissonance on the Anomaly Radio Network at anomalyradio.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at toll-free 800-513-0105, 800-513-0105. Or if you've got unlimited long distance or you're in the central Texas area, call 512-646-4404. That's area code 512-646-4404. And tell us some news that we're not covering, particularly anomaly-related, whether it be consciousness, parapsychology. We've covered some cryptozoology, Bigfoot. You know what? Yeah, that reminds me. I at least want to say this craziness between these Bigfoot nutters called the Bigfoot Hunters, or whatever the hell they call themselves, is just ridiculous between them and Lauren.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Result of a series of videos that have gotten, increasingly questionable in content, and...
I think they're literally trying to be, pardon the pun, inflammatory.
no question of that. In the latest, not exchange, that's not quite the... latest diatribe or latest manifesto?
They're putting out YouTube videos, and they've been, referring critically to their critics, and let's just say that they've resorted to burning books and just other shenanigans.
Well, they've burned a copy of a book.
Yeah, there you go.
And honestly, I thought Lauren comparing it to the Nazis burning books, was more than a little over the top. But,
well,
these guys
burning,
have
burning
also
a book and being doing what they're being over the top. That's for sure. And so,
absolutely. They've also, made some apparently very questionable remarks about Lauren's nature and his character, which, really have absolutely no place. I honestly think, Lauren's getting a certain measure of good publicity out of it. So I like to think there is some positive benefit being derived from it, but
and what's at stake here is that these guys are going out of their way to make extravagant claims, the likes of which UFO contactees haven't generated in a long time, and that is that these guys are claiming that they have a Bigfoot body that they shot or that somebody shot on ice, and that they're negotiating with their lawyers the release of this. Meanwhile, they're trying to get people to pay for, real cheap T-shirts, crappy T-shirts, to up to $400-$500 a pop for trips with them out in the woods. And after seeing these guys' videos, would anybody actually consider paying them that much money to go out in the woods with them? I mean,
well,
you'd have to be, well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, they really don't deserve all this attention, other than they're creating for cryptozoology. Actually, you know what? Maybe their whole game is they're trying to upstage Biscardi. Maybe they're deliberately trying to be ridiculous and obnoxious and discrediting to the field, because they're actually trying to upstage the other most discrediting person in the field.
Well, you know, it comes back to that old argument about, you know, the relative dignity of the profession, and why, relating it to ufology for a minute, Nick Redfern frequently, who we haven't had on in a while.
I keep realizing we need to get him back on for
an
update.
High time we did that. But, Nick Redfern, I've kind of mildly chided him for referring to the ridicule factor or the giggle factor in mainstream UFO reporting. And, you know, here there's certainly an aspect of it, because it's very difficult to take these YouTube guys seriously in any respect, but at the same time, they're making claims that, you know, if they were, you know, a shred of truth to them, would be enormously portentous.
Absolutely. And that's, I think, if I remember correctly, this whole, the whole coverage of this at Lauren Coleman's website actually was couched in a way that I find really telling, and that was, you know, if and when a body is discovered, how is it going to be revealed? You know, what sort of person might end up being the lucky ones to have such a thing, and how would they handle it? And it was, I mean, he was trying to give them, I think, these guys the benefit of the doubt at that point, even though I know he suspected as much as anybody, just from one watching of one of these stupid guys' videos, that it had to be a hoax. So, but, you know, this is also reminding me of something I want to read from. I recently got my latest edition of Jim Moseley's Saucer Smear, a lighthearted but positive look at the flying saucer scene, shockingly close to the truth. This is the July...
Which is also the title of Moseley's excellent memoir, co-written with the late Carl Flock.
Right, who was the ultimate skeptic of Roswell. and this is the special 61st anniversary Roswell edition of Saucer Smear. But here is something else that's also been covered at Cryptomundo. As usual, Moseley gives his very personal take on things. On June 22nd, we received a telephone call telling us that legendary Bigfooter Eric Beckjord had just died of prostate cancer at the age of 69. The caller was a kind California lady named Molly Hansen, who many years ago, before her current marriage, was a girlfriend of Eric's. She and her husband have, for some reason, stayed in touch with Eric all this time, and they have had sympathy for his mental and physical problems. It is indeed bad form to speak ill of the dead, but in this case, we really don't know what else to do. Your editor has known Eric Beckjord for nigh on to 40 years, having first met him in New York City, where he was showing John Keel some of his subliminal Bigfoot photographs. Subliminal means, according to our dictionary, existing below the level of conscious awareness. We have seen this man lecture in California and elsewhere, showing photos of Elvis and other celebrities on Mars. Eric was an entertaining speaker, but he never had anything of substance to say, nor did he ever write a book on Bigfoot or on any of his other offbeat interests, such as the Loch Ness Monster. He went to Loch Ness several times, sometimes financed by comparatively wealthy lady friends. He's also said to have once reenacted the famous Patterson Bigfoot film, which is believed by many to be a fake. Eric dressed up in an ape costume, and in spite of his large size, did not look at all like the biped in the classic film. Eric's last public stunt was an expedition last summer to the woods near Walnut Creek in his area of Northern California. He took along a girlfriend and also a psychotic woman named Tara, whom he knew only from the internet. A net posting says that he deliberately brought a mentally ill woman with him because he believed Bigfoot would be attracted to her condition and thus be more likely to come out of hiding. Molly Hansen disagrees with this interpretation. It does seem likely that even Eric would not grant psychiatric abilities to a primitive creature that is not even known to exist. We met Eric Beckjord many times over the years. He didn't like us, but then he made a point of not liking most of the people he knew or heard of. He was not at all respected in the field of Fortean research, and it seemed that he wanted it that way. We found him to be an interesting character and liked him mildly. We are very sorry about his demise. Apologies for this somewhat negative obituary. And, several people were commenting that it seems kind of strange in this internet age that it took, I think at least a month before word really spread on the internet that he'd passed away, and then there was suspicions that he wasn't dead and that he had faked his death. Pseudocide. Or hoaxed deaths. But,
yeah. Which is one of those, given what you said about him, it doesn't sound all that far-fetched.
Yeah, especially reading that particular writing by Mosley.
And I do want to give a, can I say shout-out, Miles?
You just did.
Yes, I did. I discovered today that Paul Kimball has decided to basically get out of UFO blogging. He intends to, maintain an interest in the field, but apparently he's withdrawing from it as a presence. His post of, I believe, the 29th, titled Omega, gives his reasons. You can look that up at www.redstarfilms.com.
.blogspot.com.
.blogspot.com. Pardon me just a sec.
Yeah, that's where I've been reminded of that Monty Morphic article about Edgar. Yes, I saw this, but I didn't read deeply. Damn it. Well, he's going to be writing for Alien Worlds. That's good. When I was trawling his website for material to talk to him about in our interview, I was really amazed at, it'd been so many years ago when he first came on the scene, on the internet at least, I still haven't seen his documentaries, any of them, which of course he's been working on for years, but he's just been a really good, rational voice, and even though I disagree with him on a lot of stuff, it's just one of those, wow, he's, mostly straightforward and rational. That's so refreshing in the field. But again, he's the one who also, like me and most of my friends, appreciate both the circus tent part of ufology but also the more respectable scientific part. So.
Anyway, it's not so much a departing as a transition. But nevertheless, I thought it worth noting, and just a good night and good luck.
Yeah. I found a really, I don't know how long it is, but there's a video over at Frank Warren's blog, the one I can never remember what to call it other than Frank Warren's blog, frankwarren.blogspot.com. Video eyewitness Scotty Littleton recounts his front row seat to the Battle of Los Angeles of 1942. And there's a video there from some little cool alternative UFO-oriented TV programming that's an interview of him. But like I said, I don't know how long it is, so I thought I'd just play at least a little bit of it here for everybody. Hold on.
Thank you. I kind of came out of the closet, not that closet, but the UFO closet, believe me, in the last 10 years, I mean, interested in this for 30 plus years, 40 years, but I started going public with it. About the last 5 years I was teaching, I taught a course called The Occult and the Paranormal and did a lot of UFO. And then, as I say, the novel was published the same year I retired. So I've kind of come out of the closet at the end of my career as taking this stuff seriously. Again, everything you say about UFOs has to, at one level, have a perhaps added to it. No, I don't have a smoking saucer in my garage. I don't have an alien body on ice in my freezer. I wish I did. But I think there's enough overwhelming amount of anecdotal evidence and evidence dating back to the Stone Age. July 1 of 1941, I turned 8. And in December of that year comes the Day of Infamy, Pearl Harbor. And less than 2 months later, there was a celebrated event occurred that is over the skies of Southern California, or L.A., the L.A. Basin, which has often been called the Battle of Los Angeles. It was the evening, the early morning hours of February 25th, 1942. Pearl Harbor was less than 3 months back, and we were all very nervous. I mean, it may sound in retrospect kind of silly, but it didn't at the time. A lot of us still thought that the Japanese Imperial Fleet was just over the horizon. My father was an air. He was a little too old for World War II. He tried to get in, but so he became an air raid warden. And we had blackouts. And we also had the whole Santa Monica Bay from Palos Verdes on the south to Malibu on the north, and several places in between, like Manhattan Beach and Redondo, were ringed with anti-aircraft batteries and searchlight batteries. Beginning shortly after the war, after they set them up in late December of 41 through January and early February, they would practice at night. They would run a drone. They'd have a ship towing a drone out over the ocean at quite a distance away, and usually from about 9 to 10, never much later than 10 o'clock, about an hour, maybe four or five nights a week, they would practice shooting at this star, you know, in case the bad guys came. At first it was exciting, and then we just took it for granted. Again, as I said, like the sound of the surf living at the beach. Well, the night in question, I woke up about 2:30 in the morning, and I heard the guns going. I looked at a little clock in my room. I'm 8 years old at this point. I said, this is weird. I mean, you know, what's they doing shooting at this hour? And not only were they shooting, but the sounds were much closer, and I looked out the window. I had an oblique view of the ocean. I saw the searchlights, and I look out the window. Oh, my God. My parents are up. So my father, anyway, just said, hey, I'm going to be an air raid. So he put on his gear and went out to try to enforce a blackout. My father got my mother and my grandparents who were living with us, and my mother's recently widowed maternal grandfather was staying with us. And they all went down to the bomb shelter. And my father, I remember saying to his father-in-law, this could be the real thing. You know, and he moved whoop, down into the, you know. We probably would have been fairly safe from anything other than a direct hit in terms of shrapnel, because the way the boxes, we didn't have bags, but cardboard boxes stacked up with sand in them. Anyway, but my mother snuck out. She said it was getting pretty, these were small little rooms. And there was no bathroom, I think just a little room, like a little cubicles with a bench. And we stocked a little some food and whatnot down there, and water, but that's in bottles. But my mother runs out, decides to go out this door, and we're standing right here, looking up in the sky. And what we saw, the searchlights had in there had focused in on a elongated, my mother always called it like a bug, kind of a lozenge shape, that was also glowing on its own, surrounded by exploding anti-aircraft shells. There was a lot of noise, but...
Anyway, this goes on for quite some time, apparently, and he's a professor of anthropology, and I guess he is also a science fiction writer, but... you know,
that's a corker of an eyewitness account. I know the Battle of Los Angeles is one of Greg Bishop's favorite cases. He's blogged on it a number of times at UFO Mystic. And it's one of those, I always lean towards the explanation that it was basically a spasm, you know, brought on by jittery war nerves. But, there are, you know, I gather there were other, perhaps second-hand eyewitness accounts, but,
you know, it's very interesting. I'll have to watch the rest of the clip, and I'll post the link to that as well. We're closing in here, and I had alluded to, some conspiracy-oriented stuff I wanted to, plug. I won't, since I played that video, I won't play this video, but... There is video of Seymour Hersh, who's broken so many crimes of the Bush administration. This one exclusive. To provoke war, Cheney considered proposal to dress up Navy SEALs as Iranians and shoot at them in order to basically instigate a casus belli, a false flag attack. And Cy Hersh is on the record now saying that this is some of the stuff that he's been writing about, but that didn't get printed in the his paper, and that was not chosen, but that apparently Cheney was suggesting this was a viable plan to get the American people behind attacking Iran by staging an incident. And so I'm going to post the link to that, and that's over at thinkprogress.org, and there's a transcript and the video. And
Hersh is the fellow who has been writing for the New York Times for years, right?
Yes, yeah. And in other quick news here, source, NASA, Phoenix mission, Tucson, Arizona, confirms Martian water, mission extended.
Woo!
Yeah. We have water, said William Boynton of the University of Arizona, lead scientist for the Thermal and Evolved Gas Analyzer, or TEGA. So that's pretty cool, folks.
Well, it definitely makes you know, the survivability of Mars a whole lot less dodgy. You know, the existence of liquid water on Mars means essentially a mission there, A, would have to take a whole lot less fuel. All they'd have to take would be a machine for making fuel out of water, which, you know, is not completely out of bounds. It also means that, well, we won't have to go looking all that far for it in order to stay there for a while. So I think that's terrific news.
It is terrific news, and I'm sure they've known it for a lot longer than this. But I would say that, wouldn't I?
You're being mind controlled by Richard Hoagland, who's bouncing beams off the face's nose.
Yeah, and bouncing it further off of the structures on Mars. So, well, folks, any final comments, Craig, before we leave, folks?
Remember our website, www.precognitivedissonance.com. Look us up on the web. Look up our 1-800 numbers. Give us a call. And keep watching the stars.
Thanks.
Keep watching Mars.
Thanks.
Keep watching Mars bars.
Keep watching.
Just
and listening.
Keep watching and keep listening.
All right, folks. Thanks. And peace. Good night.